From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. And there's probably no more interesting way to start a book than the sentence, Wayne Williams wanted to make it in the music business. It is the first line past the introduction of the book Rap Capital, an Atlanta Story. My guest is the cultural writer and commentator from the New York Times, Joe Coscarelli. Joe, first of all, so good to have you here. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Really, the whole first third of the book is about how it was so hard for people to get a grasp on how to cover Atlanta just as a social and cultural phenomenon. That was fascinating to me that you started with that.
Yeah, you know, I knew I wanted to tell some stories about Atlanta that were not directly related to the rap industry of the last, you know, 10 or 20 years, which is where most of the book focuses. And what I found was that it's almost impossible to tell an Atlanta story, either, you know, culturally, politically, historically, that doesn't somehow connect directly to the present day music scene. And that was really fascinating for me because I thought I was going to have to do a lot of stretching to make this stuff relevant. But it turned out it was more directly relevant than I even knew going in.
But what's fascinating about that, too, is, I mean, as a kid, I can tell you, when Wayne Williams started to turn up in the press, you know, if you were a person in the Black community, you go, that guy was in Jet magazine.
So you're talking about Wayne Williams, you know, better known insofar as he's known at all as the perpetrator, allegedly, of the Atlanta child murders, the serial killings that spanned the late 70s and early 80s in Black neighborhoods in Atlanta. And it's true. Yeah, Wayne Williams, in addition to wanting to be a talent manager and basically start his own Jackson 5, he had run a pirate radio station, essentially using wiring on the roofs of one of the local housing projects. And yeah, he was known in the Black press and also in the neighborhoods where these crimes were being committed even before he was arrested for them.
And that sort of intersection of basically outlier behavior and entrepreneurship, really, you can't talk about the current scene or the scene really in Atlanta over the last 20 years. Well, as you so eloquently start the book with, reminding us that it has roots that go back a lot farther than we think.
Like I said, I knew I wanted to tell the Wayne Williams story because, you know, other art writers, Maurice Hobson has a great history of Atlanta called Legend of the Black Mecca. Dr. Joycelyn Williams, another cultural academic, covered the music industry, has drawn these links between the serial killings in Black Atlanta in that time period and the music that would follow, specifically what we call trap, which is, you know, a sort of up-close document of music that surrounds the drug trade, music about the sale, production, and use of drugs, which has become Atlanta's number one cultural product, this rap music. And I knew I wanted to tell Wayne Williams' story as a sort of cosmic connection to the music that would come after. I write in the book that a lot of the artists best known from this city, you think of someone like Andre 3000 of Outkast or Gucci Mane, Young Jeezy, you know, artists from Atlanta and its suburbs. They were all children during this moment when Wayne Williams was looming so large in the Black imagination and in Black parent nightmares. But then here come to find that not only was Wayne this sort of cosmic connection to these artists, but in an artist like Lil Baby, one of the newer Atlanta rappers who I write about a lot in the book, his mother, basically, when I met her for an interview, told me that those killings, the Wayne Williams murders, as they're known, were directly responsible in many ways for her life and the way that that her family turned out and thus her son and his ultimate career.
It's an incredible scene that, as you sort of tail in the book, because people couldn't get their arms around how to deal with Atlanta in a one-sentence phrase, because New York is Gotham and L.A. is this. So you can sort of append things that may not even fit to the personalities of those cities. But because there was no singular take, or single take, I should say, on Atlanta, nobody really knew how to sort of tie that music scene together.
Exactly. And I think one of the main things I wanted to do with this book was to define Atlanta as just that, which is a music scene. I think, you know, we deny a lot of humanity often to rap music and the pockets that it comes out of. You know, it's considered ephemeral. It's not really treated in the same way that many music scenes are. You think of, you know, Seattle grunge in the 90s or London punk in the late 70s, even going back to blues and soul music and jazz. I feel like, you know, hip hop and specifically regional and southern hip hop has not been treated overall with that same level of seriousness. And I wanted to show that Atlanta is very much a music scene in the traditional sense. These are people who grew up together, went to school together, learned from one another, were rivals with one another, and it's persisted for so long. You think of someone like Coach K, the music executive and manager, Kevin Lee, who's a character in the book. This is somebody who worked with an Atlanta trailblazer like Pastor Troy, you know, more than 20 years ago, then, you know, helmed the careers of Young Jeezy and Gucci Mane, and then started up all over again, you know, in the last decade, and was behind the rise of Migos and Lil Yachty and Lil Baby and City Girls and all of Quality Control, which is the label that the book focuses on the most. But you can trace that lineage back through one specific person, and you can find those people over and over again. You know, even someone like Future, one of the most successful Atlanta rappers of the last decade, he comes directly out of the Dungeon Family, which is the collective that gave us Outkast and Goody Mob, and he came up in that very scene, even though his music to most at first listen couldn't seem further from the sort of Afrofuturist funk that Outkast was making in the mid to late 90s.
Outkast really was able to sort of get media attention to Atlanta because it was as much a pop group as it was a hip hop group. So it lent itself to that. But everything else was for a long time, as you know, everything that came out of the Southeast just kind of lumped into this big pile of dirty South, just because it became easier to sort of conflate it all into one thing than to actually try to draw the kind of historical connections that you make between all these musics.
Outkast was pushing boundaries even before they became the sort of, you know, pop hitmakers that they're known as today, Big Boi and Andre. You know, a song like Hey Ya came on basically the very last Outkast album. And even, you know, 10 years before that, at the 95 Source Awards, you have this headline moment where Outkast wins, you know, best rap group, and they're getting booed on stage by the sort of hip hop heavyweights of the time from the East Coast and LA. And, you know, everyone thinks of this war between Bad Boi and the Notorious B.I.G. and then Tupac and Suge Knight on the West Coast. And here comes Outkast, and Andre 3000 jumps on stage and you hear boos. You can look this up on YouTube. And he says the South's got something to say. And he's basically saying, like, you guys might be caught up in your own thing, but we're making something a little bit weirder down here, and you should pay attention. And it took so long. It took decades, I think, before people realized that what was happening in Atlanta over and over and over again really was leading this genre, especially down its more experimental pathways.
Again, just that listing of artists you have, each of them, be they individual or part of a collective, has a sound that's different from what's come before. I mean, there's this kind of response that has paranoia baked into it that all in some ways like move the needle rather than being a part of a consistent whole, which is different from any other hip-hop scene up until Atlanta, isn't it?
I think that's right. I was speaking with Questlove yesterday in an event, and, you know, he said that a lot of music comes, these regional scenes, you have people copying off of each other's papers. And I was thinking, yeah, but it's best when they're copying off of each other's papers and they're doing it slightly wrong. So you have, you know, an act like Migos, which is trying to sound like Gucci Mane, but is screwing it up in just enough of a way to make it really unique. And, you know, you mentioned Bando, this early Migos song it's so spare, it's so repetitive, it's so catchy. It really sounds homemade, but it has this certain energy to it that's undeniable. And I like to equate it with punk music. I think to me, Migos are basically the Ramones. This is a group that found a niche. They were able to make this visceral music using only the ingredients at hand. You know, they weren't classically trained musicians. They weren't playing instruments, but they could make it work with basically, you know, free files that they found online, trying to be like their idols, but doing something slightly warped and different. And, you know, you see that again in an artist like Young Thug, another Atlanta innovator of the last decade. He was, if you listen to his early music, he was really just trying to be Lil Wayne. He was trying to make the same music as his idol from nearby New Orleans. And yet what came out was something loopier and something, you know, altogether stranger. And that, I think, has kept Atlanta pushing the boundaries. They're not tied to this traditionalist idea that I think a lot of the hip-hop that comes out of New York or L.A., traditionally the strongholds, there's a sense of needing to follow the rule book there that artists still chafe up against. And I think Atlanta has never quite had that. It's always been a bit freer.
It's the treatment. My guest, who clearly has much cooler friends than me, is Joe Coscarelli. His book is Rap Capital, an Atlanta story. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. You said it's like they're copying it wrong. It's almost like they're imitating something somebody told them about. I think you said punk. It feels like to me almost every artist who's popped out of Atlanta in the last 10 years, that early energy all feels like punk. And there's also the sense of sort of claiming it rather than being directly imitative that I think really separates Atlanta from certainly the New York or L.A. or even Oakland hip-hop scenes.
Yeah, I think back to, subgenre like crunk, you know, when you had Lil Jon coming out in the early 2000s, there was a real sort of lawless punk quality to it. And I think that applies up through the trap music of Gucci Mane and Young Jeezy and T.I. in some sense, even what Soulja Boy was doing, you know, in the early MySpace days, some real minimalist music coming out of that period, what we called snap music at the time, you know, D4L. And I think it's important to remember, again, that at the moment this music was coming out, it was really derided. You had Nas saying hip hop is dead. You had Jay-Z saying no more auto-tune. All of this was very much pointed at rappers from the South. And yet, you know, these sounds have persisted and been reassembled and continue to evolve. Basically the pinnacle of popular culture.
It's so funny because I remember when that Nas joint dropped, I just went, oh my God, he's old. It hadn't occurred to me.
And that was 15 or 20 years ago at this point. And look, like all credit to Nas still putting out, you know, music considered vibrant by certain audiences. But I think the people, you know, clocking the latest coming out of a place like Atlanta are not necessarily sitting down to listen to, you know, the 12th Nas album.
It's this thing that the book is really about, which is something I've always said, and you actually sort of deal with from chapter to chapter. There's a ruthlessness in hip hop that doesn't exist in any other pop idiom.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I'd never thought about it exactly in those terms, but that was something I really wanted to get at in the book, which is also, you know, I wanted to zoom in and show a humanity that I think is not often afforded to these artists. But I also, on the flip side, wanted to show the business apparatus and the way these cycles work, where young kids, usually black men from little or nothing, are offered record deals that pay them maybe more money than they've ever seen at once, but ultimately not enough to live a life on, especially a lavish life that's expected of a rap star. And, you know, thrown into this system that is really just a churn of a cycle. And I think especially so in the streaming era, where, you know, these labels are not necessarily interested in minting new superstars, but they want to jump onto trends and things that are hot for the moment and then often move on to the next one. And you don't often get to see what happens after the record deal or after the hit single. And that's why I wanted to, as much as, you know, I'm praising the innovation and the success that has come out of Atlanta, I think the book is just as much about the failures. And it's about the failures of the individual artists, but also more importantly of the systems that surround them. And I think, you know, you learn as much from the guys I followed in this book who don't make it, if not more, than from the ones who do.
Absolutely. We take a break. My guest, who's not mad at Nas, is Joe Coscarelli. His book is Rap Capital, an Atlanta Story's a Treatment, which you can hear at kcrw.com/a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, Joe Coscarelli, has a terrific book on the phenomenology of rap and specifically Atlanta hip-hop, The book is about Capital and Atlanta's story. And it's so funny. You don't think about these guys as having birth names. And it's something about just using those names in the book that kind of grounds them in the way that just offering some history. I mean, were you aware of how rare this happens? Because as we were talking about before the break, because so much of the coverage of hip hop, be it trap or whatever, is about sort of trying to be a step ahead, that it doesn't very often get the sort of the historical overview that other pop forms have got.
I really wanted to try and use whatever platform I've been given, you know, as a journalist in the mainstream media and as somebody who was given the opportunity to work on a book project by, you know, a major corporation. I wanted to say, like, what's happening on your Instagram feed, on your YouTube channels, you know, it's important and it deserves saving for the historical record. I think especially as we've lost, you know, the magazines and stuff that I came up on, you know, whether it's The Village Voice and Spin or, you know, Rolling Stone is often in a pamphlet compared to what it used to be. You know, you think of magazines like Vibe and The Source and even The Fader. Like, these are either shells of their former selves or completely wiped off the face of the planet. And what we're left with instead are, you know, trending topics. And I think these artists who are making, again, some of the most culturally and commercially impactful music, not just in the country, but in the world, they deserve that treatment to have their exploits, good and bad, held up as part of music history, not just these little blips.
But even those places you were mentioning, I mean, I've worked at Rolling Stone and Spin, so I know there's this kind of fear of a black planet, those places sort of in de facto mm-hmm. ways or explicit ways. But those places such as The Source, which was ground zero for this, you mentioned that even those places, the organs that were covering that scene were derided in the mainstream, let alone the music itself.
We take for granted, I think, at this point, the South's impact, especially in rap. But yeah, you're right. These places, these artists, these executives, a lot of them have outlasted the criticism, but there really was an uphill battle. And I think part of what has made Atlanta so vibrant is that chip on its shoulder. I think the fact that it has never felt that it got the respect it deserved has resulted in a lot of these wins that we've seen come to fruition in the last 5, 10, 15 years.
I think there is a quality of a free associative thought that makes, I mean, and a lot of these things, just because it's still at this point, and you know this as well as anybody, the point we're at is still a lot of hip hop artists and rappers are not thought of as being people who are capable of introspection or depth until they're dead or 5 years after the fact of one of their singles. Mm-hmm. I think what for me has distinguished a lot of the stuff that's come out of Atlanta and all these artists we've mentioned, from Outkast to Gucci Mane, there is introspection in all of them. And I think what ends up connecting so often when these things connect is that quality of self-reflection feels as sort of universal as it does idiosyncratic.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, it can be party music and it can be aggressive and it can be even antisocial at times. But there are these real moments that cut through. The Lil Baby song that he's probably best known for as a national figure is The Bigger Picture, which is with his song, you know, after the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and the protests that followed in the summer of 2020. But if you listen very closely to that song, like it does have this free associative quality. And what I write of it in the book is that it's quite ambivalent. It's not a simplified war cry. It's complicated. And he's trying to explain his life and his relationship with the police. You know, he says, oh, like, of course I'm going to run at the first sign of blue lights behind me. This is how I grew up. And then, you know, he has a song, something like Emotionally Scarred, which is lesser known, but a real fan favorite of his and has become a slow burning hit. And something like that, you know, is as introspective, I think, as any music you would have gotten in the 90s when a guy was really putting a pen to a pad. But another thing I wanted to do in this book was talk about how Atlanta rappers made their music and the way that you say free associative. And it's true. A lot of this is not written down at all, but freestyled off the cuff in the studio. And I wanted to break down the sort of lineage of that style of recording and the kind of art you get from it. And on one hand, you get Migos chanting the same word 200 times in a song, which is, you know, hypnotic and emotional and evocative in its own way. But then you do have these artists like Lil Baby, who really incredible lyricists, if you're willing to do the work and listen a little deeper than past the accent, past the auto-tune.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Joe Cuscarelli. His book is about Capital and Atlanta story. We can't also not think about, and you get it in this book, this sort of sense of awareness. There's a running, a ticking clock, in fact, on some of these people. And this is why, to me, the tragedy of these names that evoke youth so often seem to be almost as a, like an ironic finger to fate. And we can't talk about this, you know, getting into what's happened with Migos in the past few weeks.
Yeah, so Takeoff, as you're alluding to, one third of the group Migos, you know, it's sort of quietest member, never known to be in the mix with anything sort of violent or dramatic, you know, very much like the backbone of the group, the youngest, the one who was first interested in rap music, killed in seemingly a pretty random shooting in Houston. And yeah, just one of a very long list of hip-hop artists, you know, who have been tragically killed or died over the last handful of years. And this is in the book too. You know, one of the characters I followed for many years ended up dying as I reached the end of the reporting process for the book. And I think, you know, there's something about the world that we want, that audiences want reflected back to them in music, especially at this moment. They are often very bleak. You know, the stories being told on these records, even when they do sound celebratory, like are often quite dark. The music is supposed to be an escape from that. And seeing that these artists can never quite get far enough away from their old life to really be safe. You know, you think of a group like Migos, this is an A-list group. This is, you know, these guys are in national television commercials. They're at every, you know, every red carpet event. You would think that that would come with some sort of safety. And yet here we are again.
It's unfortunate. But when you hear about, again, Mac Miller or Takeoff, you can't, well, not these guys, because these are the guys who felt in some ways like the future of the form to me, you know?
They had made it. You thought like they were out, you know?
Yeah.
But it reminds me of something actually that Lil Baby said to me right towards the end of my reporting process for the book in February of 2020, right when COVID was about to peak. And I asked him, I said, you know, do you worry for your generation of rappers? And I listed some of the names at that point, you know, that this list has only gotten longer in the time since, of people who had, you know, fallen victim to drug overdoses or random killings or targeted killings. And what he said to me was like, I don't worry about rappers. I worry about people. I'm dealing with this stuff every day in my real life, outside of the industry where I've chosen to work, that these are American problems reflected back to us in rap, which happens to be the art form that most closely, I think, you know, translates the worst and the bleakest parts of this country. And I think the fact that, you know, you're seeing opioid issues in rap, you're seeing gun violence issues in rap, that's a reflection of the world and the country that we live in today.
This gets back to what you outlined in the opening of the book about that free associative. For me, power of Atlanta music and trap in particular is that the free associative, I think, quality is sort of magnified by the fact that, you know, all these acts of violence and even success are so random. If you're trying to make a linear narrative out of it, I mean, you're not in the moment of what's happening around you. And that to me is the thing that I think at its best separates trap from all the other rap that's around.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of the most responsive genres. And I think you've seen this across hip hop, especially as the, you know, the barriers to entry have fallen. You know, you don't have to get in a recording studio. You could do this at home on your laptop and immediately have it online on Spotify and YouTube the next day. And I think the way that these micro scenes and these trends and these styles have traveled, like it's all just happening so, so, so quickly. And I think it doesn't often bubble all the way up to the mainstream. But if you're interested at all in this music or, you know, the communities that this music is documenting, the wealth of different styles and stories being told at this moment in rap is truly mind-boggling. And it's not always going to make you feel good. And I think that is as much a value of the genre as it is a downside. You know, people say, oh, this music's gotten so dark, it's gotten so violent. And I'm often like, yeah, like, look at it, you know, stare back into this and see how you feel. That's valid. And that to me is the purpose of art in many ways.
See, I agree with you, because I think the thing that, for me, it separates this from these other forms to which rap has been compared, like Black Punk, is that it's actually changed the listener's experience of what pop is supposed to be. And it's not about one producing sort of style or anything like that, but it's just all these different performers and what they've done. And I'm sort of loath to use the word soulfulness, but there is soul in all these stories of self-awareness. I mean, I think unlike so many other kinds of rap we've seen in the last 50 years, yeah, so I'm old now too, is that a lot of that was about sort of being celebratory in superficial ways. And a lot of the stuff that comes to Dollar Land is being celebratory, again, is you have this feeling that the clock is running on you.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think audiences really respond to the rawness of this music. You know, the reason I wanted to focus on this period, basically 2013 to 2020, what I call the streaming era, you know, the rise of Spotify and the rise of YouTube as a place for this music to take off. Like, to me, Bad and Bougie, the Migos song that hit number one on the Hot 100, like, that is a tipping point moment to me. You listen, you go back and you listen to that song now, and the idea that this was the biggest song in the country, it's pretty mind-boggling. There's no sacrifice. There's no bending over backwards to try to fit into the idea of what a radio song sounds like. This is in-your-face music. It's uncouth. It's aggressive in a way that, you know, gets people's adrenaline going. And I think the fact that that music is connecting both with white teenagers in the suburbs, you know, you could hear Bad and Bougie at a frat party, or you could hear it coming out of a car or a club in a black neighborhood in the South. And it's working on multiple levels. And I think, yeah, what people are really responding to is its sort of outlaw quality and its rawness and its ability to say things that you're not necessarily supposed to say in a package that doesn't feel dumbed down.
Exactly. That's the point I'm getting is that I think that what Trap has done and hasn't got its due for this, so I thank you for the book, is it's brought a sophistication to pop that I think hasn't consistently existed for this long. And again, we're talking about the 21st century, because that's really started to pop about 20 years ago in this sort of nascent and inchoate way. And so that it's still reforming. I mean, because look how long Coach K's career has been now, for God's sake. So you look at the way it kind of constantly forms and redefines itself and doesn't want to be limited by being purely imitative the way a lot of hip-hop has been, which is why a lot of these things have died out so fast. That's why Atlanta's thrived in this way for so long, because it has brought this idea of, I think, artistic ambition that it doesn't get the credit for.
That's right. I think people want to believe that this is simple, shallow, superficial music. And to me, that just represents a lack of investment. And look a little bit closer. That's all I'm asking.
The book is Rap Capital, an Atlanta Story. My guest is its author, Joe Coscarelli. Joe, thanks again for doing this.
I really appreciate it. This has been a fun and thought-provoking conversation. Thanks for having me.
New York Times culture and music reporter Joe Coscarelli, whose book, Rap Capital, an Atlanta Story, showcases the deep and varied history of Southern Black music. You can hear it keep being kept 100, God forgive me, at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Keep swinging with us. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. There's probably no more compelling title for a documentary than Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. Its director, who was last year of his documentary, Fresh Stretch, Sasha Jenkins, is here to talk about. Sasha, good to have you here. Let's talk about that title, because it really is powerful and evocative.
When you are making a film about Louis Armstrong and you know there's a song called Black and Blues, I mean, nothing could articulate what you might want to say better than that. The refrain is, the only sin is in my skin. Louis Armstrong's skin had a lot to do with where he was and what he wound up doing.
Also, too, because that obviously is so evocative because Ralph Ellison took it and used it in the opening for Invisible Man as well.
People look to music for so much, and I don't know that Armstrong woke up one day and said, I want to be an activist, but the music is always a reflection of and a reaction to the environment, especially Black music. And, you know, now that 50 plus years have passed by, it's time to reexamine Mr. Armstrong, which is what we did in the film.
But it also fits into what you want to do, really, which is to find the ways that Black culture impact mainstream culture. And you've done that in your films and the work you produced and directed. And this fits into that really perfectly, doesn't it?
Sure. But, you know, we're in interesting times. You know, I recently directed a series for Showtime called Everything's Gonna Be All White. No one knows about it really because folks saw the trailer and were triggered. You know, not just white folks, but Black folks were triggered. And the funny thing about the series is nothing that was said in that series hadn't been said before. But a lot of that, what was said in that series, you can see through the prism of Armstrong. And so the reaction to the film has been substantial and incredible. But a lot of the themes that I was dealing with in that series that turned everyone off, it's more digestible, I guess, because maybe people don't feel like they're being accused of being racist. I don't really understand, but it's undeniable when you learn about what Armstrong has been through, you can't deny what he's been through.
Well, I mean, since we're talking about everything's going to be all white, I even connect that to fresh stress in some way, in that in your work, a Black person speaking their mind can often be a threat.
Yeah, I mean, in my life, a Black person speaking their mind is often a threat.
But I mean, you're unapologetic about making that the center of the way you tell these stories. Since you brought this up, and I'm glad you did, I'm fascinated because we can see the ebb and flow over the way Armstrong was regarded about saying certain things over the course of his life. Again, I just see all these connections, you know, and just about affect, you know, and fresh stress about the way you present yourself as a Black person sets off these waves. And it's this thing that we didn't often see in documentary for a long time.
Well, I feel like every chance at bat, you've got to really swing. And, I, you know, my philosophy is who knows if I'll ever get that shot again. So I feel once I'm at the plate, I've got to really go for it. And, you know, for those who don't know, most probably don't, you know, I'm a second generation Black filmmaker. My father was a television producer and documentary filmmaker. So, and he, you know, worked on Black Journal and lots of other important things. And he felt it was important to say something when you have the platform. And I'm just a continuum of that.
It's interesting just because going back to that kind of stuff that your father did, which is about a kind of constant temperature taking in real time, it felt like kind of an interesting sort of level of expectation to place in yourself. Because again, given that a lot of that stuff was done for public television and then it sort of disappeared, you are a part of a wave that's reviving that kind of conversation in documentaries.
It's important. It's important. There are so many things that can cloud your vision, or it seems like no one knows what's true, or people just believe these days whatever they choose to believe. So I try my best to present the facts. I mean, I was a journalist before this, and people have always been like, well, how did you make the transition to documentary film? And my position is documentary film is journalism with cameras. And if you stick to the principles of journalism, honest journalism, then there's a lot of powerful things that can be done. And I just happen to be a journalist who's Black, and there are things that I might know that someone else might not. For instance, the conversation around whether or not Louis Armstrong was a quote-unquote Uncle Tom, which has been a topic of discussion in the Black community. But I, as a Black filmmaker, am uniquely poised to unpack that. I don't necessarily want to know from a white director whether or not Armstrong was an Uncle Tom, because I don't necessarily feel like it's that director's place to have that conversation. So I don't know, man, if I've got the opportunity, and I'm going to say something, because if I don't say something, obviously, hopefully someone else will, but I got to live up to certain standards.
No, I'm glad you took the shot and the opportunity, and you deal with that pretty early on in the film by somebody who I think people will be shocked to hear
thought of Armstrong in that way. And that's when Marcel's talking about how it took his father to make him listen to the music to understand how complicated a person Armstrong was.
Yeah, I mean, I think between civil rights and, you know, folks being pro-Black, generations removed from Mr. Armstrong, you know, it was easy for me in, you know, my 1980s haze of Public Enemy to just, based on the man's mannerisms, to just write him off as a sellout or someone who wasn't for the cause. But I mean, he didn't wake up saying to himself, I want to be for the cause. He woke up saying, I want to be an artist and I want to express himself. And it just becomes complicated when you're the most famous man in the world. On top of that, you're Black. There's a lot of people you've got to answer to, and you never can please everyone. Sometimes it's even more difficult to please your own people, which Armstrong encountered during his lifetime.
Yeah, that's why I brought up the fact that you used Wynton Marsalis to illustrate what a complicated person he was, because he was as much an artist as he was a Black man, and an artist in the truest sense, in the term that what he did changed the way not only jazz was performed, but popular music was performed. And having Marsalis talk about what his father had to really make him listen to, it really opened a door for Wynton Marsalis and Armstrong. And I was wondering if in musical terms, if there's a moment you had that made you have that same kind of recognition or something similar to what Marsalis talks about. You go, oh, there's more to him than just the handkerchief and the smile.
You know, I'm a musician myself, obviously not on that level, but I knew the importance of his technical ability and his, and, you know, I knew the bass information on his innovations, but he was just such a Renaissance man and so raw in terms of not formally trained in anything, which for me was very relatable because myself and everyone I grew up with, we weren't formally trained in anything. We went to New York City public schools where we were babysat, and many of us wound up in prison, just like Armstrong. Nas is someone who's a friend, and when I was telling him about the film, he tells me, well, Wonderful World is my favorite song. And I knew at that moment that I had to have him be the voice of the film because, you know, coming off of me directing a Rick James film and a Wu-Tang film, generations of me interacting with generations of folks in hip hop and beyond, Armstrong felt very familiar to me, felt like someone I grew up with. So many people I grew up with were smarter than me, more creative than me, but maybe didn't have the social capital or the opportunity. Not that I had a lot of opportunities, but Nas, for us in my neighborhood in Queens, he was Louis Armstrong. He was the guy who made it out. He's the one who had an impact around the world and has influenced people around the world. So for me, it was a full circle moment to have Nas, for instance, be the voice of Armstrong.
My guess, who I would bet is just as smart and creative as anybody he grew up with, Sasha Jenkins. His new film as director is the documentary Louis Armstrong, Black and Blues. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. And it's interesting, too, what you show in the documentary is that there were, in effect, sort of two Louis Armstrongs. And that point is really illustrated. I'm glad you used this clip. So I remember seeing it the week it went out, Ossie Davis from like the old Black Movie Showcase syndicated show he used to do, talking about seeing Armstrong when he thought nobody was around to see him. And when that clip materialized, it really took the top of my head off. I'm glad you used it.
Oh, you knew the clip.
Oh, God, I grew up on that show. That's how I found out that the movie had become The Legend of Black Charlie, because I saw it on this. It was syndicated in Detroit on weekends. So yeah, I knew that show.
Yeah, I mean, everyone is so blown away by it. Where did you get that? It was like, well, when we saw that, it was the thesis of the film. It just says it all. It's a very powerful moment.
Up until that point, you're kind of showing us all these pieces of who Armstrong was, that he was somebody who got high, that he was somebody who had some recording equipment and basically sort of voiced his id when there weren't people around to hear it, that he was this person who could play horn, but also sing in that way that basically made you realize that his trumpet playing was very close to the way people sing, which is what it's supposed to be. So having all these pieces and then having that moment of really clarification from Ossie Davis when you place in the movie is really kind of extraordinary.
The man had to navigate. You know, there's that moment in the film where he's telling the story about a gangster telling him, you know, he's going to New York tomorrow. And he's like, I don't know anything about that. And the guy pulls out a gun and shoves it in his rib and says, I think you know what I'm talking about. And he says, yeah, I guess I am going tomorrow. And he laughs with his friends. To me, humor is a sign of intelligence. And throughout this film, you see how intelligent that he is through his humor. I mean, the guy is just, I mean, he's just funny as hell. But what he had to navigate in his time or any time would be crazy, but navigating what he did when he did is just extraordinary. Not many people, let alone Black men, I'll be honest, with all that kind of pressure and stress and racism, to be able to find a way to make your way through that, that's a tall order.
In a lot of ways, he's like a hip-hop artist. I mean, he's just as profane. He uses the grammar he grew up with to change the world and to shape it and to bend the world in his direction rather than changing himself. I mean, you can't make this movie and not see a lot of points of comparison, can you?
No, but I've come to believe, you know, again, doing a Rick James film and a Wu-Tang series and now this, there's no genres when it comes to Black people in America, when it comes to the music they make. It's always a reflection of and reaction to the environment. That's why Louis Armstrong can feel very hip hop, because it's all the same stuff that is still happening. Not much has changed, if at all. If Louis was around and Nas was around, they're about the same age. I mean, they would be kicking it. I mean, they'd be kicking it regardless. But when Nas saw the film and he was like, he goes to this wonderful world and tells you the backstory, and Armstrong talks about how it's really about the block and Queens and how it was important to him. Nas is like, that's me. I'm about the block, my block in Queens, and how it's important to me and how all those people are important to me. I'm like, yeah, dude, I'm telling you, he's one of us. It's all the same people, different times, but same circumstances.
What's really fun about this too is seeing the kinds of people, not just Nas and Wynton Marsalis, but hearing Archie Shepp talk about the impact of Armstrong's music, because that's a voice that people might be surprised to hear offering such respect and affection for the voicings that Armstrong offered.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to utilize voices who were there when. You know, I didn't want to make another documentary with lots of contemporary voices who didn't know him weighing in. I mean, obviously we've got Marsalis, but he's Marsalis. Of course you want to hear from him. But yeah, Arch Shep and all the others, you know, we found great archival. You know, since we're hearing directly from Mr. Armstrong himself, why not hear directly from people who are no longer with us but really knew him?
But hearing him too, I mean, how many tapes did you guys get to go through? Because that stuff of him talking about the world and just hearing how different his voice is, the quality, the timbre of his voice when he's speaking for those recordings is so intimate. You must feel like you really, this is the key to the universe, having access to this stuff.
Yeah, these are tapes, recordings that he made in his home or sometimes on the road with friends, with himself. You know him as Mr. Hello Dolly, but when you hear him saying the N-word and all kinds of other stuff, you're like, whoa, who is this guy? Like, he's a real guy. He's a real person. I mean, with superhuman talents, of course, but with feelings like everyone else. It's pretty remarkable when you just hear his voice. It's just not what you would expect.
Exactly. It's not only that he says that stuff, but again, that the quality of his voice is different. I mean, this isn't the presentation of Louis Armstrong. You can hear the difference in the way he breathes, the comfort level when he's just talking into the recorder or talking with friends.
Again, you really see his sense of humor. He tells another story about a serviceman who was in Pearl Harbor, I believe, who came up to him, a white guy, who said, you know, I really don't like Negroes, but you're one Negro I'm really crazy about. He says, well, I appreciate your honesty, you know, and he laughs. He's telling his friend the story. I mean, can you imagine, you know, being told, yeah, I don't really like Black people, but I really like you, and having to have a sense of humor about it? He's not an everyday cat. There's no way.
It's the treatment. My guest, who very kindly changed the turn of phrase that was used in that anecdote in his film, Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues, is Sasha Jenkins. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Also, what you've done as a documentarian is to take figures or aspects of the culture that people kind of can have a set opinion about. I mean, be it Rick James, or be it Louis Armstrong, or be it, you know, the way Black people dress, or the take that people have on Black people, and to just to say, to unpack it and say, no, this is a many-faceted thing. So we get to see that all those facets of Armstrong through so many voices, through his wife, and hearing her talk about Louis and King Oliver, which I've always loved hearing the two of them play, and to hear her backstory on that and pushing him out into the road is kind of incredible stuff to have too.
I mean, let's face it, his wife was gangster. I mean, she basically said, you know, my man, if you want to be with me, you can't play second fiddle. And he's like, I can't go against King Oliver. He put me on. Like, well, either you step up or I'm out of here. And the thing about Armstrong was throughout his life, he listened to women and made choices based on advice and pushes here and there that he got from women in his life, which I think is generally pretty progressive, especially for the time. But his lady got in his ass and was like, yo, if you don't step up, I'm out. I'm outie. I'm not going to be with the number two guy. Are you kidding me?
That's the other thing, too, that's so interesting about the film is that he was constantly attracted to strong women. I mean, his last wife, and she would say, well, once he made up his mind, he made up his mind. And she tells a story about the house. I find it fascinating, too, that he was obviously attracted to these really strong-willed women who wanted what they wanted because he wanted somebody who could match up to him.
Totally, totally. I mean, you know, the story you started to tell was the wife went and bought a house and didn't tell him for 6 months because he was focused on just living out of hotels. And she said she didn't want a life for herself living out of hotels. And they had looked at apartments and he humored her, but nothing was moving forward because he was a stubborn guy. So she took matters into her own hands and bought a house and finally told him. And he was like, you know, why didn't you tell me? Well, you probably wouldn't have gone for it. And he's like, where did you get the money? Well, my man, I had my own money before I knew you. So I put my own money down. But you know what? You can handle it. You can take the note over now. And he loved that house to death. I mean, you can visit it. It's open to the public. And I'm telling you, there's a vibe in there. The guy's in there. His energy, his spirit's in there. And he just loved that place to death. And you can feel it when you go there.
I have been there. And the great thing about that place, and it comes across, especially not only in the telling of that story, but again, as you mentioned, how Wonderful World came to be created, is that it became a real home for him. And you can sort of feel in each of those rooms what it was like to live there. And the documentary makes us aware at the very beginning that he kind of lost home. And it took her to sort of build a home around him. And I think really gave him the final act for his career.
It's funny, he makes a side comment in the film when he talks about the den that he you know, spent so much time in. And he said as a kid, he said something like, you better sleep in that den, basically saying he never would have imagined something like that as an adult because when he was a kid, if he had a room that big, the entire family would have to stay in that room because that's all they could afford. So that sort of sense of knowing that he maybe realized that he had made it, but he made it on very simple terms, the fact that he can have a den dedicated to his collage art or just listening to music was a sign of making it for a guy who basically came from nothing.
For me, this idea of home, especially given that he was taken away from his home as a boy, put in this place that helped to shape him as a musician. But I think at a crucial age, and I think the documentary makes this clear, made him feel kind of rootless. And so I think him having this place to come and rest and really become the Louis Armstrong that most people know was really fascinating. He built this place and it became this place where, as we're talking about, he made this archive and it was what people call now probably a man cave. I really felt like it was finally a place he had to retreat, which he had never had before.
No, I mean, he could have lived anywhere. He could have lived in Gramercy. He could have lived in, you know, someplace fancy in Manhattan. But he chose a blue cot, well, his wife chose. And he chose to stay in an extremely blue-collar neighborhood in Queens, a working-class neighborhood in Queens. He didn't have to do that. He could have lived anywhere. He could have lived anywhere in the world. But he chose Corona, Queens, on a random-ass block.
I mean, I think what seems clear is that that place reminded him of the place that he was taken out of. Part of the reason he maybe didn't land somewhere before is that he could have been all these fancy places, but if you're going to do that, you might as well just be in a hotel. You can live someplace that doesn't feel like a home to you. And having visited that place and seeing it, hearing him talk about the way he does in the film and hearing his wife talk about it too, I mean, I think that makes for a really powerful last third of the film.
Well, it goes to the question that he himself poses in the film. When have I ever Uncle Tom'd? You know, it's like, you're living in working class Queens. Is that Uncle Tommy? Hell no. But when you hear him in his own words say, when have I ever Uncle Tom'd? You're like, think about it. Like, well, when did he ever Uncle Tom? So you're not expecting to hear these words from Louis Armstrong. That's what's great. It's expect the unexpected throughout the film. And that's what's refreshing about what I think people dig about it.
Well, tell me, too, about the way you chose the music for the film, because the music comes from a broad spectrum of places. And it feels like to me that if it's not Armstrong music, then it's music that one way or another he probably influenced.
Yeah. I mean, Terrence Blanchard did the original score. And the idea was, you know, not to make something that might step on the toes or try to compete with what Armstrong did. So he did a fantastic job. But obviously, the songs we chose, many of them serve the story. You know, Coal Cart Blues, you know, speaks to his youth and, you know, hauling coal as a kid in brothels and beyond. Black and Blues, you know, sets the stage. So the songs we chose really serve the story at the end of the day. It just gives you more information or sets up, you know, where we're going to go in the film.
And it took me back to Fresh Dress just because he's so often saying, I looked sharp.
Right. He was fly as hell. I mean, the guy was a fine artist. He can dress his ass off, funny as hell, can sing, he can play his instrument. What else do you want from one black man? I mean, what other black man in America has all of that even today? What white man has all of that even today?
Well, the man who's telling the story about the man who has all of that is Sasha Jenkins. His new film is directed as a documentary, Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Sasha. It's always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you, man.
Director Sasha Jenkins' newest documentary on Black culture is Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. It's on Apple TV+. Get past interludes, musical and otherwise, at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Olivier Award winner Sharon D. Clarke currently co-stars in the music-flavored revival of Death of a Salesman on Broadway. She's got The Treat, an epic song composed for an R&B classicist that continues to keep going, going on.
My name is Sharon D. Clarke, and this is The Treat. My inspiration is a song by Donny Hathaway called Someday We'll All Be Free. It's from his 1973 album, Extensions of a Man, and the lyrics are written by Edward Howard. I discovered this song in my sort of mid to late teens, and it became a mantra and an affirmation for me. And to this day, it's still something I play as an affirmation. When Edward Howard wrote it, he wrote it for Donny Hathaway because Donny at that time was going through some troubles, and he wrote it to encourage him, to lift him up. It's since then it's kind of been taken on as a mantra for black rights. I know Spike Lee used it in one of his movies, used in the Aretha Franklin version, and it's kind of been taken up for black rights. But what a gift from a friend for Edward Howard to write that with solely with Donnie in mind and going, I don't know how I can help you other than to give you these lyrics that I know that when you sing them will just transform into a mantra for everyone. But they are for you. They are my personal gift of love to you. And I hope you hear me. You know, sometimes we have to counsel ourselves in that way when we're not getting that from the outside world. We have to counsel ourselves and say, hold on, hang on in there. You've put in all this hard work. Hang on in. It will come to fruition for you. It's not about how it comes to fruition in the big wide world, but how you deal with yourself, how you can stand up tall in your own pride. It just always inspires me. It always inspires me to keep being me, keep trying to do the best of what I can be, of what I can do, while keeping my dignity and my pride and my strength and my self-worth and self-respect, and then sharing that with the world. Lay your dreams right up to the sky.
Someday we'll all be free. The program is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney. It was mixed by Katie Gilchrist. Help we got it from Anna Buss, Laura Kondarajan, and Desmond Taylor. Ola Poppy. Groove with past editions of The Treat at kcrw.com/thetreat. To better days, everyone. Just wait and see. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.